In AD 410, barbarians, under the command of Alaric the Visigoth, sacked Rome. In the midst of the ruins, people began to speculate. Someone, or something, or perhaps some god, must be to blame. This is the After-Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. In 380, not long before the sack of Rome, the Emperor Theodosius had declared Christianity the official religion of the empire. Perhaps, many argued, that was the problem. Many worshipped Jesus, abandoning the old gods of Rome, Jupiter, Juno, Minerva, Apollo, Aphrodite, and the rest. No doubt those gods sent the barbarians to destroy the city as punishment for the lack of piety. In Roman North Africa, there was a town called Hippo, and the bishop of Hippo, Augustine, got wind of those arguments, picked up his pen, and began writing what has become one of the world's greatest apologetic and greatest political treatises, The City of God. Wyoming Catholic College students study the City of God as sophomores and then again as seniors, at least once and sometimes twice. Their professor is political philosopher, Dr. Virginia Arbery. Dr. Arbery is our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Arbery, the barbarians attacked, Rome lay in ruins, people blamed the Christians, and St. Augustine began writing. Mm-hmm. What were his goals? What did he hope to accomplish with this book?
Augustine is facing a reaction to Christianity for being the cause of the barbarians succeeding and when Alaric comes in 410. And his response is to point out that the barbarians, for the first time in literature or in recorded history, actually respect the place of sanctuary that the Catholic churches provided, even to the pagan Romans. And his continuing argument is that your gods, your pagan gods, actually never helped you when you were in difficult circumstances. And instead of using himself as a source, he uses Cicero, he uses Scipio, he uses Scaevola, other great Roman writers who point out the ineptitude of the pagan gods. So he's defending Christianity against a serious charge and then going on to praise, actually, a period of Roman integrity, which he sees in the early Republic, where glory was a kind of virtue and actually resulted in great heroic deeds that he then uses as examples of selflessness for the Christians, who, of course, are interested in what it means to die for Christ. And so he parallels the pagan Roman, early Roman, who died for liberty, the liberty of Rome, and the Christian who dies for the liberty from sin, the prison of sin that belief in Christ provides.
The book is about both the city of God and the city of man. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the two. How are they? Mm-hmm. What are they and how are they different?
So after the long, extensive critique of the Roman pagan gods and the excesses that come with that in the theater and so forth, and after he distinguishes that early Rome from the later Rome, which was governed by what he calls a lust for domination, he goes into great detail between two cities. And this is the provocative teaching of Augustine, that we have an earthly city, the city of man, and another city to which we are properly ordered, which is the city of God. And the city of man is figuratively embodied in the person of Cain, in that early pride and fratricide of his. And the city of God is archetypally figured in Jerusalem and in the new city of heaven that Jerusalem represents. So to sort of clarify these two cities, citizenship in one or the other depends on whether one seeks one's own good through pride apart from God, or secondly, whether one is on a pilgrimage to what he calls that harbor of salvation, which is the heavenly city. One would think, one might speculate, that other human beings can know where their fellow human beings are headed, whether they're in the city of man or the city of God. But he says this is hidden to us, and God is the one who will separate the wheat from the tares, to use the biblical passage, those who have been in the earthly city, those who have been in the city of God. Not only that, he goes on to say whether each individual person is in one city or the other is hidden to that person. So there's a great dependence, given this understanding of the two cities, a great dependence on grace, and that vehicle is Christ. So he's giving us, which is so extraordinary to me as someone who loves political philosophy, a political way of thinking about spiritual things. And in doing so, the long-term result of this view of the two cities is that politics is given a secondary place to the spiritual journey. This will be picked up later by the moderns. Machiavelli will be upset. He says the Christians are weak. They don't have that military virtue. He wants to restore the old Roman glory and sees Christianity as having a terrible effect on citizenship. And Augustine has a response to that, but I'll see if you want me to go in that direction.
No, go right ahead.
Okay, well, so his response is this, Jimmy says, you know, it really doesn't matter what city a Christian lives in. You can live in any city because your pilgrimage is to that ultimate and proper to all of us through Christ, the heavenly city. But, he argues, while you are on this earth, your citizenship to the earthly city is actually enhanced by the virtues that you gain by being a Christian. And so he makes you a better father, makes you a better citizen, makes you a better ruler. And he gives us, for the first time in Christian writing, a beautiful paradigm for the Christian prince, which throughout the Middle Ages was modified and copied, and only to be overturned in 1521 by Niccolò Machiavelli.
In the introduction to the book, Augustine wrote that the city of man is, as you said, ruled by its lust to rule. Mm. Tell us about the lust of rule, the libido dominandi.
That is a very important question, and I think he begins to address it on the first page in his preface in Book 1, where he says, quoting the Aeneid, Book 6, when our progenitor politically, Aeneas, is given the charge by his father Anchises, the charge of the future Rome that isn't there yet, to pacify, battle down the proud, bring the rule of law to the world. And Augustine quotes that, and he says, who are you, Rome, to battle down the proud? Who are you to inculcate humility? That's God's role, not yours, Rome. And so the lust for domination, he says, is really the motivation for this empire that comes to be during the period of Caesar and Caesar Augustus and the following emperors. That lust for domination is the flip that Rome makes, and it can only be countered by obedience to God, which then brings about humility in the human person.
Well, he says that Rome started out being all about liberty.
Yeah.
And suddenly they were all about domination, the lust to rule.
Yes, indeed. And here is how I understand that what one writer, Pierre Manon, has called the metamorphosis of Rome from the Republic to the Empire. So the glory for liberty, he, as I mentioned before, is actually a positive thing in that it reduces or sublimates other vices that one could have, worse vices like avarice and sensuality. So the early Roman wasn't guilty of those vices because his passion for the city's freedom, wanting not to be enslaved by other cities, proved to be a spur to great heroic virtue. And that turns, of course, when the spiritedness that makes you willing to do great honorable deeds for the sake of your city then turns into the spiritedness that wants you to do great deeds for your own personal glory. That he sees when he very carefully goes through the generals from Marius Sulla to Julius Caesar and so on, who put their own fame and glory before the good of a city based on a desire for justice and the common good.
Now, how does the lust for rule inform our thinking even today about politics, government, and nations?
I think Augustine is a durable writer. His insights are a great, I would say, prophylactic. they're a protection against the impulses that right-minded rulers and citizens might have. They're a warning that because, as he puts it, if I am quoting this right, man by nature is social, right? We're political by nature, but we're quarrelsome by perversion. So this perversity in the human will, and Augustine is the great diagnostic physician of our perversity, this perversity in the human will can't be corrected by our own efforts. And that's why we have, you know, the second city. So there, I would say his writing is a corrective to those who are deluded, who might have even good intentions, but who are deluded in their own natures by what their real interest in public serving is. Is it for the common good or is it a selfish good? Augustine really microscopically details through looking at ruler after ruler in his own day, looking at person after person biblically in the Old Testament. He's giving us example after example of the archetype of the soul that's journeying just to be the one satisfied with the city of man, or the soul that knows it's unhappy and unfulfilled unless it comes to the city of God. So yeah, politically speaking, I think we have a problem if we have rulers who don't see themselves as subordinate to the divine. And that's his point. You have to subordinate your own will to the will of God.
And how does that inform the way that we then understand how to live as citizens and maybe even rulers and leaders in the city of man?
The common good is the object of civic life. But to think in terms of the common good instead of one's own good, Augustine says, just really hasn't happened yet in human experience. So in Book 18 of The City of God, he gives us a whole philosophy of the end of the city being peace, harmony. He quotes Cicero here on harmony, but how that peace can only be understood where God rules the universe, then man's nature under that dominion is divided between soul and body. Soul rules body. In the soul, the rational part must rule the irrational parts. In the family, the father rules the mother and the children and the servants. In the city, the father submits to the city. So there's a whole tier of obedience and command, if properly ordered toward the good, will bring about a flourishing citizenship, right? He's not an isolated Christian in this regard. Say, oh, you have a good Christian man, and that means he just takes care of his family. No, Augustine is pretty clear about the fact that we are citizens in the cities into which we're born, and that our virtues must help that city become the best it possibly can.
While empires, nations, and cities of this world have their glory, Augustine wrote, incomparably more glorious is that heavenly city in which for victory you have truth, for dignity, holiness, for peace, felicity, for life, eternity. It is to that heavenly city that we Christian believers belong right now. We are citizens of that city, and it's the fullness of that citizenship that we await during Advent as we look forward to the second coming of Christ and the renewal of all things. If you're a regular listener to the After Dinner Scholar, would you consider making a gift to Wyoming Catholic College as we close out the calendar year? You'll be supporting not only the After Dinner Scholar and our free distance learning courses, three more of which will be added in 2019, but also you'll be supporting our intentionally coherent undergraduate education, an education that equips graduates to bring the kingdom of God to bear on a culture of heartbreaking fragmentation, isolation, and domination. Thank you. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.